Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to know where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Have you ever heard of Marine Corps Major General Smedley Darlington Butler? Perhaps not. But in the years before World War II, General Smedley Butler would have been well known to virtually every American. Renowned for his exploits in battle, General Butler became even more famous for his stunning about-face after retirement. Today on History Counts, we talk about the life of this great American with his biographer, Professor Hans Schmidt. We'll be back with our program, Smedley Butler, Maverick Marine, after this short break.
And things happen.
We're very happy to have as our guest today Hans Schmidt, author of Maverick Marine, General Smedley Butler, and the Contradictions of American Military History. Professor Schmidt has lectured in history at universities in the United States and abroad. In addition to teaching at the State University of New York at New Paltz, Professor Schmidt taught for 5 years at the University of Zambia and 18 years at the University of Hong Kong, where he was senior lecturer in history. Professor Schmidt, thank you very much for being with us today.
Great.
Professor Schmidt, why was General Butler called a Maverick Marine?
Well, from his earliest days in the service as a teenager, he was getting into scrapes and trouble and was outspoken and would be critical of superiors and was quite independent in his own attitudes and wanting to do things his way rather than conform to professional standards as they were being reinterpreted in those days.
Although he was a Maverick, he came from a pretty mainline family. Can you talk a little bit about his family background?
Yes, so he came from upper class background. His father was a congressman, a lawyer, and a congressman for several decades, and other members of his family have been prominent in Pennsylvania politics for generations, and so he did have this kind of upper class Republican Party background. Yet he himself never went to college.
He joined the Army at a very young age.
Yes, the Marines.
How old was he when he got in?
16, I think he lied about his age, and his father, who was a congressman at the time, smoothed that over.
Well, his career in the Marines, starting from when he was 16 years old and 1898, it reads almost like a summary of early American imperialism. I mean, he seemed to touch all the bases from 1898 up through the late 1920s. When he joined, in 1898, what was America involved in?
This was the Cuban War of Independence, Spanish-American War, as it's often called, and the Marines were down there setting up a camp on the island as part of an American takeover of that Cuban situation.
You say he didn't see action in Cuba, but you say in your book that he sort of started to set his personality in, that it's particularly his relationship with enlisted people, his sort of roughneck tendencies. Could you talk about his personality?
Well, he was a rich kid, the son of a congressman, and so this sort of made him stand out in a way which made him uncomfortable. So he had to prove that he was a man, and he really wasn't a man, just a teenager. And so he adopted a kind of fighting Marine style of physical command presence, of being a trooper, of being closer to the enlisted men, and so forth. And in this way, he was able to live down the problem of being a rich kid and being politically well-connected and so forth.
Well, he had an opportunity right after Cuba to be involved in the Boxer Rebellion in China.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that experience?
Well, he was actually in the Philippines helping to put down the Philippine insurrection. and was there that he first came under fire. But because his group of Marines happened to be in the Far East, in the Philippines, they were chosen to go into China when this emergency, the Boxer Uprising, took place.
And he was actually wounded in combat in China.
Yes, right. This is where he distinguished himself as being very brave, perhaps reckless, and was wounded and given a battlefield promotion and wound up being a captain of all things at a very young age.
And during the course of his career, his bravery was noted with two Congressional Medals of Honor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the China, the Boxer Rebellion, why were foreign troops in China?
Well, there was an uprising against the unequal treaty system whereby foreign nations, the great powers, dominated China and had taken over the most lucrative treaty ports, as they were called, the commercial centers and places where the economy could be controlled. And so Chinese boxers who were members of secret societies and so forth rebelled against this. And one of the things they did was they surrounded the capital, and imperial Chinese troops joined in with them then in a kind of an intrigue, so that the foreign settlements in Beijing and also in Tianjin nearby were surrounded by hostile forces and were threatened with being overrun. So it was a colonial rescue mission then for the foreign powers to send in troops to rescue their nationals in Beijing especially.
The idea of protecting Americans, protecting American property, is a theme which runs through his next series of assignments in the Western Hemisphere, and it was part of a new military concept called the Advanced Base Format. Could you talk about that?
Yes, yeah, so the Marines were coming off the ships. Their previous duty had been to man the Navy ships. They would be riflemen on the fighting tops of sailing ships, you know, these platforms high up in the mast. And this, of course, was going out with the times and changing in technology. And so a new mission was be that they would be light infantry, colonial light infantry, you would say, comparing it with other nations, and that they would be ready and trained for interventions in various foreign countries and quasi-colonial situations.
You call it the militarization of regional policy?
Yes, right, the Caribbean, of course, and Central America.
So he was involved in a series of campaigns in Central America and the Caribbean, one in 1903 in Honduras, I think was his first one in that area. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, he was actually even before that, and I guess about the same time in Panama, which was, of course, a key to the whole thing. The midwifing of a revolution against the Colombian government to establish Panama as an independent client state of the United States.
And why did we want Panama as an independent state?
To control the canal routes and build a canal, as it turned out. It had actually been the prime area for building a canal.
So we essentially carved a piece of Colombia out of Colombia and used it as a sort of a safe place for our canal?
Yes, that's right. So Theodore Roosevelt once bragged, and I took Panama.
So Butler was there to help secure that?
Yes, he was there, right. Mm-hmm.
And the Colombians, of course, they were then intimidated by the American Marines from intervening?
Yeah, there was a rebellion against the Panamanian government by Panamanians and the U.S. forces, Butler and the Marines in particular, sort of protected them, prevented the Colombians from intervening into their own country, into a part of their own country, and that was Panama.
So economic interests of the United States really is one of the themes of this series of interventions.
Yes, economic and strategic, to develop control by developing economic control. This was later called dollar diplomacy after 1910. That the finances of all these countries and the main economic interest there would be taken over by Americans, and to keep out Europeans especially.
And what was the interest in Honduras?
As it turned out, a United Fruit Company. So there were some rebellions in Honduras featuring an anti-American regime, and so the U.S. sent in troops and supported actually a local revolution, or helped foment it to overthrow the government, and they had then a pro-American government. which later on collaborated with United Fruit Company, and you had the banana industry on the Caribbean coast there. And Butler was then, in the early 19-teens, placed in charge of a Marine Corps unit in Panama that was set up there not only to protect the canal, but especially as a kind of expeditionary force to go up either coast, east or west coast of Central America, and intervene in places like Honduras and Nicaragua and Mexico.
Well, that brings us to Nicaragua, which is a really big part of General Butler's career. He was there on three successive missions. What was our problem with the man who was running Nicaragua?
This was Zelaya, and it was a liberal regime which represented the majority of the country, as the Marines well knew and admitted in their own reports and so forth. And he was not friendly towards American interests or towards the U.S. government.
We're talking banana and coffee operations?
Coffee there, I guess, but there wasn't actually much going on. And so this was then after the advent of dollar diplomacy, which was supposed to mean then that dollars, that is, American investments and so forth, would become the main instrument of American control and not to have to rely so much on military force.
I see. And one of the reasons you cite in his book for his downfall is that the United States didn't want him to borrow money from Europeans.
Yes, that's
we
right.
Wanted him to monopolize his finance, which, as you say, would give us the leverage.
Yeah, French loans in places like Nicaragua and especially Haiti were the ones that were actually in effect at this time, and so the United States wanted to replace them with American bankers.
So what was Butler's job when he went there with the Marines?
To make sure that that the Zelaya and liberal regime was overthrown and replaced with a conservative for the other party that was pro-American, that would then establish a client government. Senator Adolfo Diaz was their leader in those days, the conservatives, who would then welcome and sign contracts and so forth with American financiers.
I see. So President Diaz was essentially an American representative, a puppet, if you will?
Perhaps so, yes, right.
And did Butler, was he involved in rebellions against the Nicaraguan government
that
we installed?
That's right. So the government, liberal government, the anti-American government, controlled the national railway line, and Butler then secured this by himself going leading Marines along these train lines and fighting some skirmishes with Nicaraguan enemies. And then the railway was then secured as an American property, which it hadn't been originally. And then the bankers came in as well.
You quote a letter that General Butler wrote to his wife, quote, It is terrible that we should be losing so many men, all because Brown brothers have money down there. Was he starting to question at that point the wisdom of the policies and
sure.
the ethics of it?
Sure. So some Marines and sailors had been killed in these skirmishes. And he wrote that letter right after some more had been killed. And so he then made that comment to his wife.
He was involved in a very large operation in Haiti, which bears some similarities to the Nicaraguan case. Can you talk about the origins of that involvement, and in particular Roger Farnham's role?
So the idea was to get out the German and French interests and replace them with American interests. And the person involved here was a man named Roger Farnham, who was a vice president of the National City Bank in New York and was also then the president of the National Railway of Haiti and of the National Bank of Haiti.
You mentioned he was also President Wilson's principal advisor in Haiti.
Yes, that's right.
So he had the whole ball of wax.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So how did Farnham manage to disable the Haitian government?
He was in control of the National Bank of Haiti, which is also the national treasury, so that he had all of the government's funds under his direct control. And he refused to release money to the government, that is, release the government's own money so they could spend it and do things that would help them stay in power and so forth. And so this was a way of destabilizing the Haitian government. And in fact, toppling it. And this was remarked upon by many observers, including U.S. naval officers.
And so the government was overthrown?
And, yes. In 1915, there was a revolution, quite bloody, with the president being dismembered in the streets, the president of Haiti being dismembered in the streets by angry mobs. And the Marines landed. They were, of course, ready, poised to do this for some time.
And we installed a government that was sympathetic, as we did in Nicaragua?
Yes, hand-picked, and this time...
Was Smedley Butler, and were the Marines involved in fighting there?
Yes. So there was resistance to the American intervention, and many skirmishes against so-called bandits, the Kakos in Haiti, their peasants, who would then, you know, ambush American patrols and in general, you know, resist.
But they were put down?
They were put down, and I guess you would say they were really more than anything else bought out. The Haitian army, such as it was eliminated entirely. And instead, the United States built up its own military force, the Gendarmerie, which consisted of Haitians as enlisted men who were trained then and given uniforms and so forth, and was officered by Americans. And so in this situation, the Marine enlisted men, privates, sergeants, and corporals and so forth, became officers in the Haitian Gendarmerie. Butler was the commander. He was a major in the Marines, and he was a general in the Haitian Gendarmerie.
Well, he eventually went back into the army, and he ends up back in China in the late 1920s. You know, whose interest was he protecting at that point?
And main American economic interest was Standard Oil Company, lighting the lamps of China, that is, with kerosene. This was the main economic interest, and Standard Oil then had depots throughout China. And so when the Marines came into China in reinforcements in 1927, they were first barracked their transport ship and their tents and so forth at the Standard Oil Pier in Shanghai. And as they went into other parts of the country, like in the north, they set up special units at Standard Oil depots and also had airfields and so forth to protect them.
Now, as a result of his various services, he ends up becoming a major general, and he's apparently going on speaking tours even as he's coming to the end of his military career, and you write in particular about an important speech he gave in 1929 at the Pittsburgh Builders Exchange. Could you talk about that speech?
In this December 1929 speech, he then told stories to a Pittsburgh Builders Exchange audience of how he had helped rig elections in Nicaragua and Haiti, and how the U.S. controlled client presidents and manipulated politics. The times were changing. This is the 30s, the Depression. Big business was being accused of munitions profiteering during World War One. Many spectacular investigations demonstrating this. And so Butler used this as one of his main lines as a public speaker and leader.
And he spoke all over the country for the VFW and other organizations?
The VFW was a bit to the left of the American Legion, although a smaller organization. And the VFW was then picking up this anti-imperialist line. In fact, Butler led them. He was their main speaker, their most popular leader. And eventually, I guess in 1937, they actually passed a platform denouncing imperialism at their national convention.
He ran for the Senate as a progressive Republican, 32.
Mm-hmm. As a dry Republican.
But from what I can see of his platform, it was very populist-oriented, calling for taxes on the rich to help the unemployed and so forth.
Yes, I guess so, right. Yeah, this is part of the politics of the times, and of course the Bonus March in 1932.
Yeah, he addressed the Bonus March. Could you talk about the Bonus March, what the veterans were seeking?
Yeah, the veterans, these are World War One veterans, and they had been legally entitled to a bonus for their service overseas and during World War One, And this was not supposed to be paid to them, I forget, until 1945 or something like that. And now it's in the early 1930s, and there many of them are destitute and unemployed. And they say, pay us the bonus now, and so we can survive, you know, our wives and families. And so a large group of them marched to Washington, D.C., and many of them had their families with them. And they set up an encampment on the Anacostia Flats just across from the Capitol area, and were essentially lobbying or pressuring to get their bonuses paid. But the Congress and the Hoover administration refused them and eventually sent in troops under General MacArthur to rout them. Butler went and joined them and stayed and slept overnight with them in a tent and made many speeches encouraging them that they had as much right to lobby the U.S. government as the United States Steel Corporation did.
He developed this theme of racketeering for capitalism to characterize America's foreign military intervention.
He was famous for his stint in Philadelphia in the mid-1920s as the director of public safety, where he had headed the police force and fought gangsterism and prohibition. And this he was then able to carry over into the 1930s as an analogy for the way big business had operated. And he had this experience in the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps were like gangsters going around invading all these foreign countries and doing so in the interest of Wall Street.
And he wrote a very important article in 1935 in the Common Sense magazine that you quote in your book, and where he talks about how he helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National Citibank boys to collect revenues. And he concludes, looking back on it, I feel I might have given Al Capone a few hints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he had seen what was going on behind the facade of rhetoric about democracy and Wilsonian idealism and so forth, and that this was actually business interests. And so he was part of that for all those years. And now he just came out and say so, and he drew the analogy, as one might do in that day and age, with gangsterism. Gangsterism was important as an adjunct of prohibition, but in the 1930s, you had all the famous gangster films. And Al Capone, of course, was himself a very well-known and sometimes celebrated figure. So Butler was able to dwell on this, and he could do this with some authority because of his experience. He was a police expert, too. I think in the same time in the early 1930s, he was one of the main national figures celebrating the FBI and calling for paramilitary state police forces around the country. So he was a strong law and order man and enemy of gangsterism, and he had the experience then which he could talk about, which was one of his main speaking vehicles, was the anti-imperialist one. I was a gangster for Wall Street.
He anticipated World War II, say, as early as 1935. He was strong for pro-neutrality. He opposed President Roosevelt's buildup of the Navy, and he even supported a constitutional amendment to bar sending the Army outside the U.S. or the Panama Canal. He was very farsighted.
These were all things that were happening. So the Ludlow Amendment to the Constitution, for instance, would have called for a national referendum to vote before the country could go to war. And Butler supported that quite strongly. So there are a lot of people doing this. Many church groups, for instance, were pacifists. And it's striking then that the veterans movements were also joining in on this. And that Butler, probably the main role that he played.
Well, as I understand it, a great majority of Americans before Pearl Harbor were opposed to our intervention in European war.
Yeah, certainly until the late 30s, right? Yep.
There's a very powerful speech that you cite. It was a radio speech he gave in October 1939, just after the war began in Europe, and it's addressed to the mothers of possible future soldiers. Could you talk about that speech?
So he had been in France in World War One, though he wasn't actually in the front lines, but everybody knew these horror war stories. And so he would just point out to them, look, you want to go to another war in Europe, you're going to send your kids there, and they're going to get machine gunned, and their bodies will be strung up on barbed wire. And so he dramatized that. And Also, the fact that the veterans were treated so badly that they wouldn't get their bonus paid. Many of them are mutilated and so forth. So he kind of worked this as on a class lines basis. He had one veteran once in one of his speeches, and he was awarding them Purple Hearts, giving them the medals or something. And the veteran had no legs, and so he said, you know, I bet the favorite crowd, the bankers, wouldn't want to sacrifice their legs for $10 a month. So this was part of the class warfare of the period, and Butler was certainly very sincere in this, and this followed up on his being a soldier's general for all those decades beforehand.
He was a really unique character in that he was an important speaker for the League Against Fascism. Huey Long, you wrote, would have considered making him Secretary of War if he became president.
Yep.
And in 1936, he supported the socialist presidential candidate Norman Thomas.
Right.
Yet, on the other hand, he was a red-blooded American hero who didn't stint on American defense.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. For defense, but not for military adventures overseas.
You could say, quote, Butler retained an aura of red-blooded American heroism that reinforced his credibility throughout the strenuous anti-imperialistic apostasy that followed.
Yeah.
So he was the hero as anti-imperialist.
Right, yeah. So in terms of American political culture of the time, he had the stature. He was a major general in the Marine Corps. He had two Congressional Medals of Honor. And he was a famous hero from his various military exploits. And so this lent some weight and gave him, you know, a platform from which to speak. And, yeah.
What do you think his legacy is today?
Well, having written this book, I'm aware that people are still interested in it. So especially before the last elections were coming up, there are various peace groups who were holding up Butler as an example. I think there was a film, The Corporation, which was in a critique of American corporate profiteering and political manipulation. And Butler was there. He was one of the segments of this for 4 or 5 minutes, sitting behind his desk, giving one of his anti-imperialist talks.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today, Professor Schmidt. This is Ken McDermott, and I've been talking to Hans Schmidt, author of Maverick Marine, General Smedley Butler, and the Contradictions of American Military History. History Counts will be back in a moment after this short break. In 1935, General Smedley Butler wrote, "I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests, make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank, helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street, helped purify Nicaragua for Brown Brothers, brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests, helped make Honduras right for American fruit companies. In China, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. I might have given Al Capone a few hints." You've been listening to History Counts, where history provides the roadmap to the future, and the future belongs to the people. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of this program and others. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.
You just press a button and things happen.